I'll be facing this towards me so that I can watch to make sure that the dial, you know, that the reels are already going, because I've got spare batteries, but you never know if something goes on. And if there's any need to pause, hit the pause button for anything. Okay. It is Wednesday, June 19, I hope. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is Paul Rodell, again, the IBS Oral History Project, and I'm sitting in the dining area of the home of William or Bill. I don't know which one Bill. You use Bill. Okay. Wengerd, and did I pronounce it again?
That's
okay.
Right.
Laos IBS, 1964-66, working in agriculture, and we've just had a nice dinner and good conversation and such, and we're starting to talk. My first question, I outlined this before turning the tape on, as everyone else asked the interviewee to, you know, tell about their own self in terms of their background, their when they were born, their parents, education, interests, all I guess eventually leading toward a decision of volunteering for this particular agency at this particular time in their life, and what were all their motivations. So, with that as the intro for the official stuff, and then the question, I'll push this tape recorder in more in your direction, and I'll shut up, I hope.
Okay, I was born in 1940 in Springs, Pennsylvania, very rural, small town in southwestern Pennsylvania. At the age of 7, we moved to a farm, and my father was, at that time, he was working the farm part-time, and also he was a roofer. Both my mother and father were graduates. They only attended school till the 8th grade, and it was a rough life for my dad, trying to take care of the farm and also the roofing business. So at one point he decided to concentrate on the roofing business. He had 4 brothers, and he saw that the roofing business wasn't going to be able to support all 4 boys, so I was the one that was selected to go off to college. So I went to college, I went to Penn State, got a BS degree in civil engineering, and my first job was with the Los Angeles County Road Department. And I was raised in a very good religious family, and Mennonite by background. And as Mennonites, we were conscientious objectors to war. And of course, when it came time to fulfill your military obligation, we had to do some kind of alternative service. And the primary way to do that in those days was to work in a mental hospital, as an orderly type thing. And I would, at that time, was considering joining the Navy, but of course I had a color problem and wouldn't have been able to get into officer training. And I had this opportunity.
Do you have a what problem?
Color problem. I have a red-green color deficiency.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, I found out about the IBS program, and this was a means of alternative service. And so I said, yeah, this is what I want to do. And so when I found out that they were having a group going to Laos, I immediately got on board and was selected to go. And I was in Los Angeles at the time, and I was I was ready to move on and do something else with my life.
But, yeah.
So anyway, that's how I came to make the decision to go with IBS.
Well, how did you hear about the IBS? You say you heard about it.
Well, the Mennonite Central Committee was the one that helped to get the conscientious objectors to find them a place to work that would fulfill the military obligation. So they were constantly feeding information. This would be acceptable. This would be a program that would be possible.
Okay. So it came through church, basically.
Basically through church, yeah. Right.
Yeah, yeah. No, because I asked that clarification because there were some people who joined because they saw something on a bulletin board in, mm-hmm. on school. Others, one person I talked to, subscribed to the newspaper Christian Century. There was an advertisement in that, so I was just, you know, some people word of mouth.
Yeah.
Did you know any former volunteers?
No, I didn't know anybody. I didn't even know about the IVS program.
Until you tell that.
Till then, that's right.
Well, how did they present it?
Well, I think they sent a one-page flyer describing mm-hmm. what the program was, what was available, and who the contact person was. And they just put me in touch with IVS Washington.
And okay. The
minute I got in touch with them, they then started feeding the information to me.
So they were the ones who told you about the program. The Mennonites did not.
No, they just made me aware that there was a program.
That there was this agency, right. And you should at least investigate.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. That's still a good service. So that I wrote down, how did you learn about IVS? And was there any particular interest in Laos, per se? Because you seem to highlight that as an immediate attraction.
Well, it was. I had always had a desire to go overseas. In fact, if I would have had my druthers, I would have gone. My first job out of college would have been overseas somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So was it anything particular with Laos? Or
nothing particular. It was just I was really looking at the program rather than the country, rather than a particular place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. No, that's... Yeah, that's... And it was adventure.
Yeah.
So there was religious, or, well, it wasn't like you were going to carry on any conversion stuff, so it wasn't religious in that sense.
No, it wasn't religious in that. It was religious only from the aspect that having been raised as a Mennonite, having mm-hmm. an objection to war as such,
mm-hmm.
that here was a program that would fulfill my military obligation. But no, as far as going over and trying to convert people, no.
Yeah. So, if you would list all the motivations, you'd have the fulfillment of the service,
right.
Adventure, travel overseas, work overseas.
Right, and also I knew I was going to be able to work in my profession, too. Because it was, they had a need at the time for someone that was going to be able to be in construction and work on dams and canals, that type of thing. And also some of the hygiene programs, like doing latrines and well rings, that type of things.
Okay, yeah. They gave you a job description?
Not as such, but it was laid out that USAID, of course, was... they were supplying all the funding for the program in Laos,
mm-hmm.
and I knew that I was going to be assigned to rural development, was really what I was assigned to, and I knew that I was going to be working in the irrigation program. They had a program in irrigation type thing in rural development.
Mm-hmm.
So this looked very attractive to me.
So it was more than just getting overseas.
Yeah, oh yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did your farm background help you?
No, not in the work that I was doing there. Except from the standpoint that the farming is hard work. I mean, it's long hours and little pay, and so it fit right in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I am struck by how many people have come from small farm backgrounds.
Is that right?
Yeah. What were your jobs when you were growing up? I mean, there were the four brothers, so probably you all had something to do to help out Dad.
Yeah, right. There was a regular progression. You'd first start out, it would be like perhaps gathering the eggs.
Yeah.
Then you'd move up as you would grow older and another brother would come along. It mm-hmm. would be maybe providing the feed, getting the silage out of the silo. There was kind of a pecking order there where you kept moving up in responsibility type
mm-hmm,
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, in the summertime, it would be, this was back before they had combines, and we had combines, so it would be taking and shocking the oats, putting it in shocks,
mm-hmm.
And
which means what? Because I don't know that myself.
Well, when they would cut the oats or the wheat, it would be put in bundles.
Right.
And
this is the...
Yeah, it'd be a group of stalks of grain tied together.
Yeah.
It's a piece of binder twine. And then all these individual sheaves would be, you'd stay them up in a circle, and then you'd put a cap over them. The grain would be pointed up, and you'd put a cap over it so that when it would rain, it wouldn't get the grain wet.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have to take those things, you'd load them up onto a wagon, take them into the barn, and a threshing machine would come in.
Uh-huh.
Dusty, dirty work. Yeah.
So what happened once you were accepted?
Into the program at last?
Yeah.
I was pushed because the draft board was really kind of on my tail to get on with fulfilling
really?
My requirement, yeah.
That was 64.
Yeah, well, but you didn't have time. Like, the draft was still in effect in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were drafted, you didn't wait around. You had to go. But in alternative service, you know, there came a time when the draft board was getting upset if you didn't.
I didn't know that there were people being called up in like 63. I thought it came later, but they were after you.
Yeah, probably it was because of the alternative service type thing. See, I had almost an automatic exemption from
mm-hmm.
the draft, but still you had to fulfill your requirements by doing some kind of alternative service.
So even if no one
even
was being called up,
that's right.
They wanted to make sure you were doing your bit.
You had to do your bit, that's correct.
Oh, so people who were doing alternative service, people who were conscientious objectors, still had to do it during peacetime.
Yeah.
Whereas people who were not
would be able
to skate by without any responsibility.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize that before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and something had been nagging me. I was wondering why all these people who were either Brethren or Mennonite were doing this alternative service during a time when no one was being drafted. I couldn't figure it out before.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah.
Okay, it may be obvious, but it just didn't strike me. What sort of training and orientation did you have before you arrived?
In Laos.
Yeah. Well, was there any training or orientation in the States first, and then anything else in Laos?
Yeah, we had about a week in Washington before mm-hmm. we went overseas. They got us together. I forget exactly what we did, but I think they went over more or less some of the things that you were expected to do, some of the things you were expected not to do, went over some of the cultural mores type
mm-hmm,
things,
mm-hmm.
things to watch out for, just general orientation. And then we headed out on the plane.
After 1 week.
After 1 week, yeah. And we had some downtime on the way. We spent 3 days in Japan, in Tokyo. And then we spent one overnight in Vietnam with the IVS people there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was into Cambodia and just to change planes and end up to Laos. Then we got to Laos and we had like a week of orientation in Vientiane.
Okay.
Which is where the administrative capital is. And then we went up to Luang Prabang. And mm-hmm. there we had 2 months of language training and further orientation.
Okay.
And at the same time, then, we were starting to get into our work situations where we would have this orientation like in the morning, and then in the afternoon we would go out and we'd be maybe visiting local villages around and getting to know the people.
Uh-huh,
we'd
uh-huh.
be working with the local officials, like the local Lao person that would be head of the agriculture department.
Uh-huh.
Getting to know people in general,
mm-hmm.
and also getting to know more of the IVS people, too.
Yeah,
that was a good time, because it gave us time to really concentrate on the language. We'd go to a market, they'd have a market there, and we'd be able to use our language training, like we'd do nothing but go out and ask, what is this?
Yeah.
What's that?
Mm-hmm.
How much is this? And to get into some of the bargaining. I think that was one of the biggest, that was the single most thing that made our total stay there more worthwhile, because we were beginning to get a real feel for the people, the language, and and the whole situation there.
Mm-hmm. What were some of your first impressions of the country?
Well, we were eating our meals at a local Vietnamese restaurant, and I recall this man that was running the place. One of the people there said he was in the latter stages of syphilis. His eyes were half propped open. And he was a Vietnamese chef, and he had one day he served us pork chops.
Uh-huh.
And as I was cutting my pork chop here, a worm came crawling out of the pork chop. But at that time, I mean, we were having some trouble with the food to begin with.
Yeah.
And when you saw that, it was...
Lost your appetite?
Not really, no. You were so hungry that you kind of worked your way around it. And,
okay. You know. You acclimatized fast.
Yeah.
Well, what other kinds of, impressions would you get?
Well, the disparity between the rich and the poor, really. I mean, there weren't that many rich people, but we being foreigners in that particular city, we were invited to all, the royal family lived in Luang Prabang.
Uh-huh.
And there was one of the princesses got married while we were there. And of course, we were invited as guests to that wedding. And to see how they lived and to see how the villagers really respected them. You know, really deified them. And then on the other hand, seeing the... at the time, you would have thought it was really poverty that the people were living in, because they were living in thatched huts, chickens running underneath. They were elevated to stay up out of the rains. But after you were there for a while, you realized that these were normal living conditions, that they had everything they needed. They had the rice. I mean, that's their sole work, was to get enough food to eat. And that they really weren't poor. They were poor as far as not having any money, but they didn't need any money. There was nothing to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were happy. They were family-oriented. It's been so long ago, you know, initial impressions get dull.
Yeah, I'll just tell you a couple of mine. When I hit Manila, was first when they opened the plane door and all the heat came in.
Yeah.
Right. Like, oh my God. And then the other one was the smell in Manila.
Oh,
it was
really
filthy, and, you know, all the rivers backed up. And, yes. And our joy when somebody found near the hotel where they put us, in my group, Mike Martin, found an AMW place.
Oh, yeah.
We went out and went out for hamburgers. But, you know, some of those first impressions are usually pretty dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that going off to the prince's wedding was something that's not soon forgotten.
Oh, yeah, it was. I mean, because there again, with the orientation, we were... really cautioned to, when you were sitting down in a room, your head had to be lower than the king and the queen's head, and you couldn't point your feet at anyone, because that was really taboo. It was a sign of disgrace if you pointed your foot at someone. Mm. Those type of things. But yeah, it was awesome to be in a palace, you know, and even though it was just in Laos, but here was the king's palace, and these people were really respected and revered, and... the food was just bountiful. I mean, they had, of course, good cooks, and they had hors d'oeuvres of all kinds. Champagne was flowing freely. Mm. And they danced all night long.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was... to be there and be just the average common type person and to be invited to this kind of a function, and it was solely because you were a white man in...
Right.
In a country, but they did respect the IBS, had a good program there, and they knew we were there to help them out. And also the ambassadors. I mean, you'd never been in the audience with an ambassador before, and here were some very important people, ambassadors, that you were talking with one-on-one. I mean, for me, that was kind of special.
Oh, I understand. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're young.
Yeah.
You had only one job.
Right.
You just got your first degree, really.
Yeah.
and suddenly you're talking with the honorable representative of so and so. You know, like, whoa.
Yeah. What am I doing here?
Who, me? I'm a farm kid.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. Before, you were telling me who the folks were in your group. Could you enumerate those again?
Yeah. Now, one was Joe Buzowicz,
mm-hmm.
and Frank Ziegler, who was
right.
an ex Peace Corps from India, and it was a married couple, Ruth and Bob Worley, and there was another girl. I can't recall her name. Time. I think it was maybe Elaine Emily.
Okay. Did you work with any of these people, closely during your time?
Yeah, Joe Buzowicz and I were good friends.
Uh-huh.
We not only worked together most of our time there, but he and I traveled extensively uh-huh. through Southeast Asia. We went to the Philippines, that tour that I was telling you about
okay.
earlier, from Hong Kong to Manila and back into the back country for 3 days, and then down to Jakarta and Bali, and back up through Malaysia, and through Thailand, and back to Laos.
Mm-hmm.
So Joe and I were together most of the time, starting out in Zengon, near Luang Prabang, and then he and I kind of parted ways about the end of the first year. And then they were forming, one of my most interesting experiences there was when they formed some forward area teams. And these teams they'd put people out in very remote areas where the Pathet Lao had maybe just moved out of a village.
Uh-huh.
And what they were trying to do was put some of an American presence in there to see what they could do to stabilize the area and to win friends and influence people. That was seemed to me to be the biggest reason for being out there. And it was remote, and it was, these were land, I mean, the roads, there was no way to get out by road because bridges were out.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way we could get in and out was by short takeoff and landing aircraft run by Air America or by helicopter. And we had...
Do you remember the name of the aircraft? I'm trying to remember.
Helio Couriers.
The Helio Couriers, right, yes.
And there was another one, Pontius Pilot.
Pontius
Porter.
Really?
Yeah, both, all beautiful aircraft. I mean, they take off and they go up.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice, yeah. They were very slow flying planes, but they had this ability to, land and
go anywhere.
Yeah, you're aware of what they are.
Yeah.
But anyway, we were... In this particular area, we were strictly there more or less to, it seemed like, to gather information. We surveyed the surrounding villages.
For what? Just numbers of people and...
Primarily numbers of people, and we were asking questions like, what could we do to help you? What would,
mm-hmm.
If we could in some way help you out, what would be your biggest need? And we'd try and list down through 1, 2, 3, 4, what their needs were. I think a lot of this information was strictly intelligence type thing. But we had a good time while we were there. We were developing relationships with the villagers.
Uh-huh.
We were dealing with the local government officials. We did some small things to help them out too, like the well rings. But it was so remote, it was hard to get supplies in and out.
What do you mean by well rings?
Well, like they might just have a hole in the ground where uh-huh. they'd be dipping water out. It would be sloppy all around. It would
yep.
be unsanitary. The rains would wash in. And so what we would do is we had some well ring forms, and we would reinforce these well rings with bamboo and pour the well rings, and then you'd excavate the well down deeper and put these well rings in. It would prevent surface water from getting into the wells. Could also give them a place, a much easier way to get the water out. Now you could throw a bucket down in and
uh-huh.
bring it up out. And it was just more convenient for them.
Okay.
And more sanitary.
Yeah, that's what it is. I thought it was the mm-hmm. rings that were going on, like a bushing of a pump that's bringing
no.
the water up.
No, these things were like 4 feet in diameter.
Okay, yeah, yeah. That became apparent that
yeah.
you were talking about something big for construction.
Yeah. Right.
And not just some pieces and parts of objects. So where was this particular place?
Muang Kasi. It was a Muang Kasi. It was about It was north of Vientiane, the administrative capital, and then the next major town north was Vong Vieng,
mm-hmm.
and then this was north of that, yes. So it was somewhere between the Vientiane and Luang Prabang.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like on a line going north-south.
Right.
It would be
north-south.
somewhere in the middle.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I don't know all the geography, so.
It was in the northern part of the country. It was mountainous around here, very picturesque. It had
uh-huh.
It had high mountains surrounding it, and a lot of the time you'd have clouds that would be floating halfway up on the
mm-hmm.
on the mountains. Just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. What kind of people were there?
They were the lowland Lao,
and they were
rice growers. That's all they did there.
Uh-huh.
And there was one, it was strictly a village, it might have been a village of 100 houses, and there was nothing for the people to buy. There was one shop. We were living at the time in a half of the house that a Vietnamese couple lived in the other half, and they had a soup shop.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they really sold anything. I don't think there were really any... There was no place for a person to buy anything. But this village had been going back and forth from the Pathet Lao to the royal government forces a number of times. And these people, every time when the village would go back and forth, they would lose money, you know, because they would, let's say if the Pathet Lao came in, they'd give them maybe a tenth of, they'd trade in the royal money for about a tenth of what it was worth.
Uh-huh.
Then it would go the other way and they'd lose out again. So three times back and forth, and these people had lost any money that they had, and they didn't have much to begin with. But there again, you sat and you wondered, what do these people need money for? There's nothing for them to buy. That even if they had $1 million and they could buy an automobile, you couldn't run it. A bicycle even did them little good, mm-hmm. because there was, again, no place. It was, you had to walk everywhere you went. So those are the kind of things that, you know, it made you think about our way of life and what. Yeah, we have all the conveniences, and it's nice and all. But that's why I went back, and in my journal, I remembered that notation, that what right does any society have to come in? And what right does any society have to try and change another society that's been in balance for generations?
Uh-huh.
And that's what I saw back in Mona Cassini, that these people were basically happy and content. And if what their biggest problem was going back and forth from Pathet Lao to the royal government forces. Back and forth, and the government was really doing nothing for them, so they didn't care really, as I saw it, they didn't care whose side they were on, but they just wanted stability, to be left alone.
Yeah.
And they basically were happy people. I thought they mm-hmm. were happy people. They were very family-oriented. Hard workers.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the Pathet Lao would control the area and then the government.
Yeah.
Did you hear anything about how the Pathet Lao treated the folks when they were in charge of the area?
They were afraid of them. Yeah.
The local people were. Uh-huh.
Yes. Because, and that's one of the first things that we had real problems with here was because they were... A lot of the people were afraid to associate with us because uh-huh. they knew that not too far lurking in the distance were the Pathet Lao.
Uh-huh.
And if they really came on and socialized and talked to us, they would be identified. And when the Pathet Lao came back, they would be the ones that would be done in with.
Uh-huh.
But
by done in with, you mean that literally?
Well, yeah, I don't know exactly
okay.
what. They weren't really that free to speak, and we mm-hmm. didn't have interpreters with us, but there were questions like that that you really didn't get into detail with too much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we didn't really have any trouble. I mean, we attended did a lot of socializing, going to dances and that, and we never really felt threatened by being there. We always had some royal government forces with us, but these people were, you wouldn't have trusted your life with them. I mean, they were very undisciplined. And the guy that put us out there from USAID, he told us when we went out there, when we first went out there, we didn't have any weapons. And the first time we were in town and we were going back, he said, I think you guys better take some M1 carbines with you. He said, if anything happens, he said, you have two choices. One is to go out in the jungle and take your chances with the tigers, or he said, you do what you need to do with the weapons. Here I said to myself, you know, I'm a conscientious objector to war, but here they're offering me a carbine, and what do you do? But there again, it was one of those what ifs. You do what you need to do at the time.
Did you take the carbine?
Yeah, we had them, and we never used them, though. But one time, it was a good intimidation thing, because Joe Owen was with me out there in Munkasi, and he was a pretty good marksman. And
Joe
Owen. Oh,
That a Laotian?
Yeah. No, he was an IBS.
Oh, Joe Owen.
O-O-N-N. I think that was his name.
Okay. All right.
Anyway, we got off of the short takeoff and landing plane. Had just dropped us off there, and there were some Royal Government troops there with us. Anyway, Joe spotted something like a can or a bottle about halfway down the runway. And he was just itching to try out his weapon, so he pulled this weapon up. Up and he let fly with it, and bingo, the can jumped up in the air, and these government.
I think I'm having fun. You know? But anyway, so I was looking up An's name here, see if I could find it. O-N-N, huh?
I think he died, he might have died there. I think he drowned in the river at Munkasi.
Oh, really?
There was one fellow that did drown, and I almost drowned in that river while I was there.
Oh, so maybe he's deceased, because they have his name here, but no address.
That's why I think he's the guy that died.
Well, I'll put a deceased and then a question mark
yeah,
here.
Put a question mark.
Drowned.
Perhaps drowned.
Maybe, yeah. Perhaps drowned. In what river?
I don't recall what the name of it was.
And, okay, just in river. When would that have been?
That would have been right after we left.
About 65?
About 65. About 65.
Okay. Okay. Because I'd like to, as part of the study, you know, make some references to the people who did die. You know, sometimes in ambushes and such, and there were a few of those.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another drowning I heard of some guy named Murphy who was in...
Well, maybe that was a good one.
Well, I think this fellow was in Vietnam.
Okay.
Yeah, so it wouldn't have related to this fellow. But anyway, so I'm sorry. Joe tries out his gun.
Mm-hmm.
The can goes flying. The Royal Lao mouths drop open.
Right. And that wasn't enough. He did it to see. He shot off another... Squeezed off another round, and he hit the can again, and they were really astounded. So from that point on, we had pretty good respect in the area.
No kidding. The word went out. Huh?
Yeah, right.
You mean just among the troops or wider?
Oh, how wider. I mean,
really?
But this was a very tricky river. Our house in Munkasi was on one side of the river, and the landing strip was on the other side of the river.
Uh-huh.
And I happened to be there by myself one day, and we had a shortwave radio. We had to check in morning and evening with USAID.
Really?
And the Long Prabang, yeah. And
because of the security situation?
Because of the security, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And if we didn't call in, they would have a chopper there quick.
Really?
Yeah. But anyway, so you never really knew. Sometimes you would know the plane was coming in. Other times they just happened to be in the area and they'd come by, either with to drop off mail or pick up mail or take you back to town.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there by myself for the weekend. And my buddy had gone in for R&R. And this plane came in. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't expecting it, and I don't know what I was doing at the time, but I lit out like a banshee for the airstrip. And the river was very rapid. There were rapids right there, but it was only about knee-deep. And I had some high boots on at the time, like
mm-hmm.
not cowboy boots, but that type of thing. Anyway, I knew I wouldn't have time because these pilots were very itchy when they came in there, and they'd only wait for a few minutes, and if they didn't see any white men around, off they'd go again.
How come?
Because they were afraid of security.
Was there really that much of a reason, or was it because they didn't know the area and they were just kind of spooked by?
Both. There was a reason for concern.
Okay.
So anyway, I laid into the river with my boots on, and the river was only knee-deep, but it was so swift, and the rocks were so slippery, that before I knew it, bingo, out went my legs from under me. And you think, well, you just scramble up, but you go bouncing down the rocks, and of course, below every rapids is a pool that is deeper. And I got swept into this bigger and deeper pool. And of course, I was fully clothed, and with these boots on, I had exerted myself to the maximum. And it was to the point that I had given up, and I felt myself sinking down. But before I was underwater, my feet hit the bottom, and I just crawled out on the other side, and I said, thanks, God.
Hmm.
I mean, I didn't care at that point whether the plane was there or not.
But no, in this same
river, after we left there,
uh-huh.
is where a guy did drown. They found his body
a few Long weeks. Ocean?
No, IBS.
I have your answer,
yeah.
Okay.
A few weeks later, they found him down river.
Yeah. Now, when things would... when we get rainy season in the Philippines, I described to you my place. It was pretty remote.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no bridges, mm-hmm. but there were two or three rivers to forge.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were up, we didn't cross.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there was a tree that could be chopped
mm-hmm.
to you know, go over the river, and then we'd strip it of bark, because you don't want the bark slipping off while you're walking on it.
Yeah.
But of course, that would make it slippery as hell. But if you could get across one way or another, even if you had to straddle it all the way across and, you know, get a human chain going
mm-hmm.
to pass people over. But it's scary.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't think so.
No.
Just this deep, and suddenly...
That's right. Yeah, you're gone.
Yeah, you're fighting for your life. While you were talking there, I was making up the tape label, which is keeping me occupied, not thinking. You had your friend that you went on the circle tour around Southeast Asia with. You had a parting of ways. You mean the personal,
well,
or he went off and did some other work?
He went off and did some other work.
Okay.
He wanted to go up to Sam Tong and work with Pop Buell. It was his big...
Oh, did he?
Yeah, and he did. And he...
And what was his name again?
Joe Buzowicz,
okay.
Right. And I don't think he was in agriculture, and he...
Uh-huh.
But he, I think he maybe worked while he was still with IBS. He was up at Sam Tong for some time. But
mm-hmm.
he stayed on like I did for an extra 6 months. He was going to stay on.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did get up. He was up working with the people up in, with Pop Buell. But he came down with hepatitis, and his stay was curtailed short. They sent him home.
Oh, wow. That was during IVS?
Yeah. No, that was
the IVA. Yeah, AID. Yeah, he is in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin.
Yeah,
he's
from Wisconsin.
Yeah. He hasn't sent in anything, but I know where Oconomowoc is. It's way the hell off, so I don't care. But, okay, so he went off to do that. So, let's see, we talked a little bit about your work. There was the work in the forward areas, and how much time was taken up with your work?
You mean totally in a day's time?
Yeah, in a normal routine, a monthly sort of, or seasonal kind of fluctuation.
Okay. Well, starting from when we first got there, the forward area teams were not till the second year I was there.
Okay, yeah,
first
you jumped ahead a little bit.
Right.
Which is fine, you know, because it was a good story.
Okay, after the language training in the Luang Prabang area, we
mm-hmm.
were out in Zeng'an, which was that was about an hour's drive south of Luang Prabang. And there was a need for dams in the area. This was a good agricultural area, and they the villagers had bamboo dams. They were just diversion dams so that they would turn water into the canals, which would wind around the hills to get to the rice paddies. They had two problems with the dams and the canals. One, the bamboo dams in the rainy season would wash out 5, 6, 10 times a season, and they would have to go back and repair the dams. And we would come along, and we would find in the, very close to where they had their existing dam, we would find maybe an outcrop of rock.
Mm-hmm.
And we would supply the villagers with all the materials that they needed, the cement, and we would give, we had reinforcing rod, and they would make bamboo baskets, and they would screen out of the river, they would screen the materials for the concrete. They would, some kind of rocks or pebbles, and then we'd get some sand. And then we'd show them how to mix the concrete. We'd just use the simple proportion, one cement, two sand, and three gravel. And we would supply them with lumber to make the forms up. We would make up an apparatus so that we could bend hooks in the ends of the rebar. And these dams were maybe only 8 or 9 inches thick, and maybe at the most they'd be a foot high if we found the right place. And then we'd drill down into the rock, build the forms, and we'd leave a channel in the middle of the dam where you could put a gate down in it to turn the water into the canal.
Kind of then, sluice it through.
Right, and then we'd go down along the canal because, of course, in the rainy season, rains would just come down incessantly.
Right.
Sometimes for a week at a time, nonstop rain.
Mm-hmm.
And so this excess water would fill the canal up, perhaps, and it would breach somewhere.
Yeah.
And, of course, it'd have to be repaired. So we'd go and find a place where we could put in a controlled overflow, build it out of whatever was available in the area, rocks, and use some mortar in it, and we'd repair the canal. The working schedule for something like that would be from the time the villagers would get around, which I don't recall what time it was, but it would be, I would say, pretty early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And
before it got hot.
Yeah, before it got hot, and then we'd work, I don't know how long in the afternoon, until it seemed like a good time to quit.
Yeah.
And we'd work for 10 days at a time because they had like every 10th day off. They were Buddhists, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have various other holidays, but it was just, we'd work except when they'd have one of these religious holidays or whatever.
Were they, would you typify them or call them good workers?
Very good workers because they had, they knew that it was going to save them work in the end.
Yeah.
That it would give them some stability as far as being able to have water for their rice paddies. And I think they enjoyed it, too. Because we'd be right in there with them, mixing the concrete up. Usually, sometimes we'd have a, excuse me, a Thai engineer on the job, too. And he'd be doing a lot of the teaching. And helping too. I mean, we'd all pitch right in. We were all in this thing together. And I think that's what helped the situation too, because they saw we were interested. We were not just directing and we were not just supervising, but we were actually working alongside them somewhat too. Very good cooperation, yeah.
Yeah.
And some of the other programs, like the well rings, this was very close to Luang Prabang, which was, they had their own water supply and all that. And it seemed like the closer you were to the cities, maybe the less cooperation you would have on like well rings or latrines. Latrines were, in some areas, were an abject failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, we'd take the concrete and it was, had some kind of a form. It would be just the squatter type, like you would have seen in the Philippines. And then you'd have to have a bucket of water somewhere to flush down. It'd be just a pit in the ground with one of these concrete slabs. With a, it was more than just a hole in the concrete slab. But we'd put more than one of those things in, and they still would use the river as a bathroom. And in Xing'an, we had to do our bathing in the river, too, because there was no running water. So, and it was dusty in the dry season. Dust just all over the place. And you'd come back, and in the cold cold season, I don't know what temperature the river was and the air was, but it was so cold you couldn't really get in, but you were so covered with dust that you had to get clean. You just couldn't sleep that way, so you just get splash some water on you, get some soap on you, and then once you had soap on you, you had to dive in and get cleaned up. But anyway, the villagers would go to the bathroom, of course, downstream, and you'd always bathe upstream.
Yeah, you'd have to be sure to bathe upstream.
And the people would get haul their water from the river, too. They'd always get it upstream, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, but you never were sure how far upstream you have to go.
No, that's right. But Zingon, in the Zingon area, was where we did most of... In my IVS, with my IVS work, that's where most of the dams, I think there were four or five dams in that area. One of these canals crossed another stream. And so that was one of the things that I was really happiest with, is that we had to cross this other stream, and we built like a viaduct across this stream. And it was probably, 15 feet high, and we had like 12-inch concrete piers, two of them side by side, and then we had concrete beams on top of these piers. It was like a regular bridge.
Yeah.
But then we put in this Armco culvert type thing. It was a corrugated culvert to carry the water over this. And of course, the corrugated the culvert leaked like a sieve, and we had real trouble. It took a while to get that sucker sealed up. I mean, I don't know. We used all kinds of things to get it. And it was kind of touch and go, because the villagers, this was... It was not something to be expected, that here we had spent all this time and work, and yet we were losing most of the water out of this corrugated culvert. But it wound up eventually doing the trick. But I really enjoyed that aspect the most of my time in Laos, was working on these concrete dams. And then that's what I was doing when I was with USAID, too, is I was in doing that. That was my sole function with USAID.
Dam built, dam construction.
Dam and canal.
And sluices and the like.
Right, but there is more of a supervisory role on every, with USAID like that, they would have a Thai engineer on every job. And these were engineers that had gone through the Thailand system of schools, they had been to a university, they were more or less graduate civil engineers. So they knew what to do pretty much. I would just have to help them out with some design work a little bit. And I would make the rounds, and I would see what they needed, make sure that the supplies would get there. But that was really interesting, too, because one of these, one of my areas of concern was in Sayaburi. And there you'd leave the guest house, the IVS, or the USAID guest house, and you'd drive.
IVS and USAID guest house? It was one and the same.
One and the same, right.
Okay.
Right. And you'd drive by jeep maybe an hour or so to a river port. You'd hire a boat and you'd go upstream maybe 3 hours. And then you'd have to walk overland another 2 hours or so. And you'd visit at the dam site with these guys for an hour, see how it was coming along, help them in any way you could. Then it was retracing the route back again. So it was from before sunup until well after sundown. And they were really long days. But it was good work. I enjoyed it, and you'd get to the village. You could hardly wait to get to the village, because first thing they do is send the little guys up the coconut trees, get some coconuts down, cut the tops off, drink that coconut. You know. Because other than that, the only thing you could have to drink would be boiled tea, hot tea.
Right.
So the coconut milk was, it wasn't cold, but it was cool. So anyway, in Zingon was my IVS dam building, and then after that at some point came Moen Kasi, the forward area team. And then I had a brief period that I spent somewhere else. But most of my time was in the northern part of the country. I did get down to Pakse and Savonikhet in the southern part of the country, but just for visits more or less with other IVS people to see what was going on down there.
Again, that was during your IVS time.
IVS time, yeah.
Yeah.
USAID time, there wasn't. And with IVS, in the IVS days, we would have, every 2 months or so, we would get back to civilization, get back to Vientiane, where we could get, in the commissary, we could get our type of foods. They had a meal house here. You could get good food. But with the USAID tour there, we didn't really have much time off, and we were much more gainfully employed.
Yeah.
In switching over from the IVS to AID, what were the motivations there?
Primarily, it was to get a few coins stored up to be able to spend a month and a half coming home. Plus, it was getting to be like home in a way. It was an easy life because you didn't have the pressures back here that you'd have back here. A lot of people stayed on with USAID and went with USAID in other countries. I saw the danger in doing that. I didn't want to be an expatriate all like that all my life. But I said, okay, for 6 months I'll do it in order to be able to be comfortable and have a nice journey back. And I was glad that I did that.
Harry, you said it was like almost like home. That's interesting. If you could elaborate that, what do you mean by like at home?
I mean, you were becoming really acclimated to the culture, to to the food, to the ways of life. Plus, anywhere you went, you were revered and respected. I mean, the villagers, you know, elevated you much above you were here. And I think that to a lot of people, well, to everybody, it gives you a great sense of power, not power, but it gives you a great feeling that here people, they're almost adoring you. That here you're a white man and you're here working with them. You know, they hold you on a pedestal. It kind of, it does something for you. I think it's a bad type of a thing that it does for you, but it kind of has a pull to stay there, you know?
I felt that too. No, and you just had to put it in perspective and get a life on it. Getting all wrapped up on it.
Because I knew I had missed a lot. I'm a sports type person, and I like... but you miss all that stuff. I mean, I remember coming back in Amsterdam, so you walk into a place and you hear a song playing, or you come back here and you say, oh, is that a new song? Oh, no, that was 2 years ago. It was popular. So you realize that here was a 2.5-year chunk out of your life that...
where you became disconnected from your own...
Very much so, yeah.
But how did you, a while ago though, you were talking about, you know, the I don't know, what's the word, disjuncture between, you know, here these people have had a nice life and you're coming in, but you're even extending on further to work with USAID.
Well, see, that was in the front of my journal, and I wish I knew where that comment came from. It wasn't my comment, I don't think. But it was something that made an impression on me. It was probably something that I read. But let's say when you first got there and you saw what they had, and you began to identify with that type of a thing, because we had an impact on the people there. But when we left there, and when the United States presence left, I wondered, you know, what did we really leave with them except some good people-to-people type relationships? But on the other hand, here we showed them tools, we showed them equipment, we showed them technology that they didn't have before, and that after we left and after the U.S. presence left, they weren't going to have again. I doubt to this day that they have gone much further than what they were when we were there 30-some years ago. So that's what the context of that was. I think it was something that I put down to wrestle with. Maybe it was maybe that was something that came out of IVS Washington. Maybe that was somewhere in Washington.
Now, I didn't know the context of it, so I thought there might have been some sort of difference between that thought and then staying, you know, and continuing to work on it even longer.
Oh, no. That was the reason for staying longer was strictly a monetary type.
Yeah, okay. All right. So before we were talking a little bit about how you had known or met, although in passing, the legendary Popule. So if you could describe some of that to me, I'd appreciate hearing what he was from someone who had at least met him.
Mm-hmm. As I recall him, he was rather short in stature, but he was just a total bundle of energy. I mean, he was, he didn't stand still for a minute. He was moving, walking, talking, greeting people, just constantly on the go, dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Respected. I mean, he was, every IBS person knew of him before you went and after you came home. And I mean, I never did really work with him, never did really get to know him.
Mm-hmm.
But those were my thoughts of him and the few brief times that I did see him.
So it was pretty much a positive thing for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and everywhere, I mean, the villagers even, see, he was working with the Hills tribes people, the Mayo,
mm-hmm.
and even the lowland Lao people were aware of him.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, they were aware of what was going on up in the hills and the mountains.
What were they thinking?
I think they were for him. I mean, they were, because these people were, of course, on the side of the government, they were working to keep the potted Lao out,
mm-hmm.
doing their bit. And as I recall, yeah, the Lao people were in approval of the situation.
Okay.
Because the Lao people were basically laid-back people. They're not a warrior-type people. But the Mayo were. They
mm-hmm.
were fierce, living in high altitudes where they were rugged. And the lowland Lao were kind of afraid of them, even.
Oh.
They were the ones that grew the opium up in the mountains, and
mm-hmm.
they'd bring it down to the lowland Lao and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, colorful people, the Mayo. They wore the, you know, mostly black robes, but they'd have silver adorning them, and the women especially were very colorful people.
Mm-hmm.
They grow corn too, and they were slash and burn agriculturists. They'd burn off a mountainside
mm-hmm.
so they could sow their corn. That was one thing that I wanted to do while I was there and before I left. Was I wanted to go up and spend some time with them, the Mayo people. And I came close to doing it, but someone cautioned me against it because they said, you know, to go by yourself and to go up there, you don't know whether you'll ever come back again or not. So I took their advice. And
who were they to say that? I mean, people who knew, really, or
well,
just friends of yours in IBS who said,
well,
not a good idea, Bill.
Yeah, right. I mean, people that had no vision.
Oh.
No, it was risky. I mean, it was risky, obviously. You don't, as a foreigner, to go trooping around through the mountains, you didn't know your way. You know, you could have met up with anything.
But I would have assumed that you would have approached somebody who was already working up there and just gone with them sometime.
That would have been the thing to do.
Yeah.
I guess I really hadn't carried it that far.
Okay.
It was in my mind to do that.
Yeah. Because I, you know, that advice I would say.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you're younger and you're not thinking.
That's right.
You know, you're doing things that you'd say, whoa, wait a minute, what am I doing? Oh, I wanted to get, let me put it on pause while I look over this thing, put this back on again. How did you get along with AID when you were still with IBS? What did you think about them, and were they helpful to you?
Very helpful. There were two gentlemen that I was working with in irrigation. See, irrigation was under the Agricultural Department of UC, I guess. And
mm-hmm.
Earl Rambo and the other gentleman's name I forget. But anyway, I was, as an IBS person, was more or less given over to AID.
Mm-hmm.
And they used me, they sent me wherever they wanted to, wherever the need was. And IBS was more or less just an administrative. They did the administrative work. I still reported to them, to IBS, but as far as the work situation, I was controlled by AID. They treated me very fairly, very nicely. Very good working relationship with
mm-hmm. And you mentioned that there was the IBS slash AID home.
Yeah, and so I agree. This was common throughout the country because the facilities were very crude. And that's how close IBS and Abe were more or less one and the same in Laos.
So they knew who they were recruiting for 6 months afterwards because they'd already worked with you so much.
That's right. There was no recruitment there. It was here's your job. Please stay on.
Yeah.
Okay. And rightfully so, because they were paying, they were funding the whole IBS program. I mean, so yeah, we were IBS and we were distinct, separate and distinct, and we worked out in the villages. The aid people were, maybe one overnight in some semi-remote area, but they weren't out in the villages like we were. And there again, that's why they were happy to get IBS people to stay on, because we could now then, as aid people, spend time out in the villages and do the work, continue on. We were continuing to do the same type of work as we did before. Only now we were getting paid for it.
And your ability to be a volunteer and live out in the villages. I almost said in the bush, but I'm not sure if that's exactly the right word to use. Gave you a distinct advantage over most AID people, or were just a different aspect of work?
No, much more effective we could be, because we have had already spent 2 years in the country. We knew the language. We could travel wherever we wanted to and get along in the language. The aid people, not being out all that time, they would, even in Vientiane, they were living in an aid compound. They would drive the 6 kilometers to the USAID compound. And their total work day was surrounded by people that spoke English. So after we had spent 2 years in the country, we could we knew the countryside, we knew the language, we knew the villages, we could converse with them. We didn't have to go through an interpreter. In fact, sometimes we would work as an interpreter with the locals when a USAID person was there. So, yeah, I would say we were much more effective after the 2 years with IBS, and then swinging over to AID.
And even still while you were with IBS. So you're, just personally, your language must have improved drastically.
You mean, is it, while we were there?
Well, you yourself. I mean, going from the market and pointing and learning the prices and so that you could later act as an interpreter.
I mean, we still weren't that fluent in the language, but we were more than adequately able to get along. Yeah, but there again, you saw the people, too. There were people that didn't put forth the effort, to either didn't necessarily have the ability to get deeply into the language or didn't want to. But we had a motivation, since we were going to be out working with the villagers, to really get ourselves involved and all that. There were some people that really wanted to get involved, and those were the people that learned the language.
You're talking about IBS people.
IBS people. I'm saying there were IBS people that...
Some didn't, some didn't.
Some didn't. Yeah. Okay. Like the married couple, they...